loudest weekend of the year is back. Louder Than Life in Louisville, Kentucky. With Slayer. Slipknot. Motley Crue. Korn. Judas Priest. Disturbed. Five Finger Death Punch, Breaking Benjamin, Evanescence, Falling in Reverse, The Offspring, and so many more. September 26th through 29th in Louisville, Kentucky. Passes on sale now at louderthanlifefestival.com.
Don't go to sleep, motherfucker. Don't go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian, and this is Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories, flying solo without Murdoch this week, and we just spent time on the show talking about Sam Cooke. We told the story of a session musician who's named Earl Palmer, who accidentally ends up in the right place at the right time to play on this song, A Change Is Gonna Come. You know this song, right? Then we traced the story of that song and how it became an anthem, because Sam dies under suspicious circumstances in a seedy motel in Watts. So I want those stories to stand alone and be considered for their importance. They're important stories to rock and roll history, to the civil rights movement, to history, to American history. So hard stop. I'm letting those stories stand alone. They're significant. But given what we discuss on this show, it's hard to cover those stories and not be tempted to walk into the Level 9 soap opera rumor and innuendo that ensues in Sam's household after he dies. So, with all due respect to Sam, today I think we want to tackle the tale of the man who shows up wearing Sam's suit and driving Sam's car with Sam's woman to Sam's funeral. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to unravel the story of Bobby Womack. Now, let's start here. I'm a big fan of the incredibly diplomatic way that Steve Huey from Roe v. will write the Bobby Womack bio. This is like what you'll find on streaming services. Here's the opening paragraph. A veteran who paid his dues for over a decade before getting his shot at solo stardom, Bobby Womack persevered through tragedy and addiction to emerge as one of soul music's great survivors. That is some coded language right there. Tragedy and addiction. Okay, let's talk Bobby Womack history. First thing to say about Bobby Womack is he's a guitar player. The second thing to say is that he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So if you are not familiar, that's fine, but take those credentials. And he also starts in a family situation that's very similar to where Sam Cooke begins, which is a gospel singing ensemble of a family. Now, there is an age gap. Sam is older. Sam is born in 1931. Bobby is born in 1944. So they're 13 years apart. And I emphasize guitar player because there's this great story that Bobby will tell about his childhood. Now, he's born in Cleveland. It's 1944. He's one of five boys. His dad's a steel worker, and he's a part-time minister, and he's a hobbyist guitar player. But they're dirt poor. And there is one rule in the house, and that rule is do not touch dad's guitar. But no one follows this rule. Now, to hear Bobby tell it, all five of them, all five kids, are going to learn to play guitar secretly on this instrument. And then one night, eight-year-old Bobby breaks a string, and they're all freaked out. All the kids freaking out. This is the one rule in the house. Don't touch dad's guitar. Now there is irrefutable evidence that they have touched the guitar. Bobby goes, he gets a shoestring. He tries to restring the guitar with a shoestring. Now, I was thinking about times I've attempted something as stupid as trying to make it look like everything was okay with a shoestring. There is a guitar story in my house. My dad sort of like permanently loans and then eventually gives me his Yamaha FG300. He bought it in the late 70s. And when I learned to play guitar when I was 12, he teaches me on that guitar, gets me the basics, lets me take lessons on it. And then it becomes mine. It's in my house. It's in the studio. So I treasure and love this guitar, but when I'm 12, I want to be a rock and roller. And I'm playing on an acoustic guitar, and I'm playing with a plastic pick, and I'm not paying attention. I'm just playing open chords. And I distinctly remember a day when my dad walks into my room, and he catches the guitar in a certain slant of light, and he's like, "What happened?" And to this day, I could show you basically where the pick had ground away, you know, a section of the top of that guitar from my strum pattern, my reckless 12-year-old, 13-year-old strum pattern. And he was visibly upset. Now, he realized it was an instrument. I was not in trouble. He didn't really even scold me. But I could tell that I had really, it hurt him. And I still feel a little bad about it. Now, you know, beat up guitar. What's the good of a guitar that doesn't get played, right? And a 12-year-old, you know, yeah, not the most careful type. It's funny, though, because I've thought of this several times where my 12-year-old has taken something and totally disregarded it of mine. And I'm realizing, oh, yeah, like he has no idea that I care about that thing or that he's even abusing it because he's 12 and he has no perspective. So that's about as close as I can remember. I never really tried to pull off like the, you know, pretend the window isn't broken stuff, put the vase back together with super glue. I knew that stuff wouldn't fly in my house, but I've damaged a guitar and watched somebody's face fall. And this is what happened. So the dad comes home and he discovers his string's broken. He's mad. He's told these kids one stinking rule. I work so hard. I have multiple jobs. The one thing I want to do is be able to strum my guitar when I get home. We can't even afford the strings. You broke it, and you did a terrible job of even trying to cover it up because a shoestring is ridiculous. But he stops. This is the way the story goes, to hear Bobby Womack tell it. He stops, and he says, "So wait a second. You're telling me that you know how to play guitar." Here's a quote from Bobby in his biography about what happens. Quote, "Even with one string short, I picked up the guitar when he asked me to." Because this is the idea, right? He asks him to prove that he can play. "I picked up the guitar and I played classical music. I played soul. I played country and western. And I played rock and roll. I played my ass off. And every lick I knew, and then some that I didn't, I played. And when I finished, Dad was in shock. He couldn't believe how good I had gotten, and he'd been really selfish holding onto that guitar for himself." And, side note, this is just fun if you're a guitar player or a musicologist, Bobby's left-handed. So he learns to play this guitar. Unlike his brothers, he flips that thing upside down. My best friend, growing up, left-handed guitar player, and he would do that all the time. He would take my guitar, flip it over, and play it. So, by the time Bobby's 10, this family has turned into, they've gone from don't touch a guitar to full-blown musical group. They're the Womack brothers. And in our talks about Sam Cooke, we like breeze through his early years, but he's in this gospel group at the same time. Now, again, he's 13 years older than Bobby, but there's a group that he's in called the Soul Stirrers. And the dad in the situation, Dad Womack, is looking for a break for his boys. And in 1956, he lines up this show. I don't know if he books them or how he does it. It's church stuff, right? So it's a little different than, like, you know, Showtime at the Apollo. He lines up the Womack brothers to get on a bill with the Soul Stirrers. He knows what he's doing. Bobby will phrase it this way in later years. "Sam was on the gospel highway, so we got on right after him." So Sam will teach them about touring, and then he'll form a record label, SAR Records, and he signs them and he puts out some of these gospel records. But Sam sees potential way beyond the gospel market. Now remember, he did this for himself, and now he's turning around and he's doing it for Bobby Womack. He pretty quickly gets them to do a few things: to change their name so they become the Valentinos, change their location, they moved to LA from Cleveland, and change their style. They will become a soul pop group who is singing about love in a more general sense and less of a specific sense about God's affection for us. Now, again, Bobby doesn't just sing, right? Bobby plays guitar. So on top of all of this, Sam will eventually hire Bobby to be in his band. But remember, age and timeline. Let's check that. This is all happening to Bobby when he is very young. He was born in 1944. So when he hits the road with Sam in the early 60s, he's a high school dropout at this point. He's like 16. And one of the first hits they have, I love this, they literally take a gospel song and they rewrite it. It had been called Couldn't Hear Nobody Pray. That was the name of the tune. They changed it to Looking for Love. Now, you might go looking for love. Do I know that? You do, because not only will it become a hit for them, it becomes the first top 40 single for Jay Giles Band a decade after it's a hit for the Valentinos. The Jay Giles Band. Yes, Centerfold. Jay Giles Band. Now, this transition from gospel to pop, it's orchestrated by Sam. It's something he'd already done. I mentioned that. He knew how to do it, and he had actually done this as well. He had taken a gospel song and made it a generic love song. There's a great piece in the show notes called The Soul Stirrer by Barney Hoskins, and it goes pretty deep on this period. If you find any of this interesting, this like gospel period, or this transitional out of gospel into pop period, it describes this battle that happens between Art Rube at Specialty Records and Bumps Blackwell, who helps Sam break wide. But this all got me thinking when reading about this in this period about how I'm actually used to seeing this happen the opposite way, because I grew up in 90s Christian youth group culture. If you listen to the show, I've talked about this a ton. You know this already, right? So there was always this idea that you could take a secular song. That's what we called it. I have a feeling somebody's listening. They're like, what? Secular? What? Secular. S-E-C-U-L-A-R. That's non-spiritual. I only know what that means because I've only, as a small child, heard it applied to music. Don't listen to secular music. That was a phrase that I heard. Okay, so they would take a secular song that was clearly about, you know, your girlfriend or whatever, and they would make it about God. And this was a urge that had to be fought by youth pastors all over the world in the 90s. I assume it has lasted past then, but you don't. I don't feel it or see it as much. There was even this, I'm not kidding, I had this sampler. I don't think I ever had one of the records, but I had the sampler that had this Weird Al style rock band called Apologetics with an X. Do you know what apologetics are? All right, look that up, how it relates to the Bible. Anyway, their pun was apologetics with an X, and they rewrote rock songs to make them about Christian topics. And I specifically remember they had a version of Come Out and Play by The Offspring, and I feel like I don't have to tell you how they renamed that. But here's the other one I remember. So apologetics for sure. And then there was Mark Farner, legitimately the lead singer of Grand Funk Railroad. He becomes a Christian at some point, and he rewrites Some Kind of Wonderful, and he makes it about Jesus. So that's a real thing. And you can, I believe I threw it in the show notes, if you want to hear Mark Farner's version of Some Kind of Wonderful, in which it is overtly and specifically meant to be about Jesus Christ. So good stuff. So that's how I'm used to seeing this happen, right? You go from non-Christian to Christian, as opposed to taking a song that is about the love of God and making it about the love of a woman. Not a huge jump, but a jump nonetheless. So here's what we're trying to establish. Sam was in Bobby's life ever since he was a kid. So if he meets him when he's 8, that means Sam is 21. Okay? And Sam's a mentor. But they have this artistic partnership as well. You will read about them writing songs together in the car while they're on tour. They are making things together. And Bobby's family that he sings with, they are around Sam and his family and early in the Soul Stirrers. And then as Sam moves into adulthood and he has built a family of his own, they're around that family. And so if we're going to talk about Sam's family, we got to talk about the woman he's married to at the time in the early 60s when all of the other things we've been talking about happen. All right, and her name is Barbara Campbell Cook. This is a classic dysfunctional relationship disguised as a long-term romance. There is a 5-year age gap here, which isn't that much, except for the fact that they meet when Barbara is 13 and Sam is 18. And remember, He's been singing in this popular Chicago singing group since he was 14. You read anything about Sam Cooke very quickly, someone is going to say that he had more trouble getting girls to leave him alone than he did having, you know, than he did the problem I had, which was getting girls to pay attention to him. But he's very interested. Out of all of the options that he has as an 18-year-old male, he becomes very interested in a 13-year-old girl from the first time they meet. She moves away, then she moves back. They sneak off. They find time together. They both have relationships with other people, but they keep floating back to each other's orbit. Again, just to timeline things. Sam and Barbara meet in 1948. She's 13. They marry in 1958 when she is 23. But they have a child together in 1953, and her name is Linda. So by me telling you that, you may get the sense that this relationship has its challenges. In that gap between 53 and 58, Sam actually marries someone else. He has a whole other marriage. And we talked about this before when we talked about Sam. He does develop a bit of a relationship as a womanizer, which, until Britney Spears reclaimed that word, was a real sort of, I don't know, like gin and tonic sort of way of saying a guy that couldn't keep his member in his pants, right? It's pretty well documented he was not faithful to Barbara, or to anyone, really. And he was not faithful to Barbara before or after they were married. Obviously, he wasn't on the night that he was killed, because we have talked about what he was after, what was going on that night in most of versions of the story. And you might remember that, at least according to some of the reports, and his, you know, Sam's biographer, Peter Gerlinick, the reason Alan Klein called off this private investigator who was looking into Sam's death was that he was worried what might go public about this marriage. It was definitely headed for divorce. We know that. And this relationship faced a lot of pressure, if we're being fair. Even if the child from 1953 was not involved, even if there was not craziness and fame, Sam and Barbara had tons of issues, like the on-again-off nature of it early on, the age gap, and then they'll end up getting married in 58 and having two more kids. So they have Tracy in 60. You'll remember she's the namesake of the company that Alan Klein sets up for Sam's music. And then they have a child named Vincent, their first son, in 1961. In 1963, Vincent will die by falling in the backyard pool. Now, this is under Barbara's watch, so you can imagine this did not make anything about the marriage easier. I personally cannot imagine the sort of stress that puts on a marriage relationship. Now, let's take a moment and acknowledge that that is awful. Despite all the stuff we're going to talk about, hard stop. These are people who suffered something unimaginable. Okay, so now, that's 63. Remember, Sam will die in 64. So when Sam dies, Bobby is 20 years old. Barbara is now 29. And to hear Peter Gerlinick tell it, a definitive biographer, as I mentioned, of Sam, both Barbara and Bobby will have a totally different story on how what ends up happening will happen. Gerlinick does document that while Sam is out on the night he dies, running around with women he met at swanky restaurants, Barbara might not have been at home alone. There's a version of this story that starts with Bobby at some point showing up at Barbara's house in the days after Sam's death and finding a bartender that she'd been entertaining on and off for some time, it seems. And he was, quote, wearing Sam's watch, ring, and robe. Here's the quote from Bobby. "This motherfucker's trying to fuck over my hero." So he promptly throws the guy out of the house. But as for how this turns romantic between Bobby and Barbara, now there's different accounts of that story. Here's Bobby's version. Bobby says that a few days after Sam's death, she calls him and says, I got a problem with a tape recorder. I got a tech problem, Bobby. I've got this tape. I think it's supposed to have Sam on it or something. She wants to hear it. She can't get it to play. So he comes over and he tries to fix it. And while he's leaned over trying to fix this tape machine, he turns around and she's right behind him. And they have this conversation in which she says this is his chance to, quote, be a big man. And the best part of the story is that when Bobby tells this story, he claims that his answer to that is, I just want to get the tape to work. This is Bobby speaking. Quote, it was like The Graduate. She went in the house and came back in a red robe, full length. It was like The Graduate. Now, of course, he's referencing The Graduate later. This is not in real time because The Graduate, at the time of this happening, has not come out yet. So he's very worried in Bobby's telling of this. He's very worried about the ghost of Sam kicking his ass. I'm not kidding when I say he's worried about the ghost. Not like worried about besmirching his reputation. Not like feels bad or guilty. Worried about a ghost kicking his ass. Now, I can relate a little bit because this is something that my wife claims she will do to me if I try to make it with one of her friends after she dies. Fair enough. I don't know if this is a common conversation that long-term relationship partners have. It's definitely one we've had. I have very clear instructions. Do not have sex with my friends. Fair enough. But all this to say, Bobby's version of this story, which is totally worth a read if you grab Dream Boogie, the Gerlinick book, flip to the end. There's a chapter entitled Aftermath, and it's in there. He paints this thing, Bobby, paints this thing as being a manipulative seduction. And he swears that after they make love for the first time, the front doors are wide open to the house when they wake up the next morning. And he took this as a sign of Sam letting him know he was watching him. Now, this is not the version of the story that Barbara tells. She says it very different. She acts like it was cautious. Like he was cautious specifically, but that he was definitely into it. Not really how he explains it initially. Now, he says there was this fake emergency setup. She will say that he was at the house after the kids went to bed. They got to talking. And here's how Gerlinick paints it in the book. I'm reading from the book. Then it hit her all of a sudden how death and sexual attraction went hand in hand. He looked a little scared, but when she indicated her feelings, he did not turn her down. So this is how Bobby Womack shows up to Sam's funeral with his wife, with his car, in his goddamn suit. Now, this leads to a lot of mistrust of Bobby all the way around. You might imagine that there is a pretty easy assumption here that the affair has started before Sam's death. So when friends, family members, people in general, the public, hear about this, they think, okay, so Sam's wife was running around on him with his guitar player? And I know that there is a lot of perception that men, especially historically, have not had to pay the price for misdeeds the way women have. Weirdly, not the case in Bobby Womack's case. This turns a bunch of his friends against him. Here's one of the reasons why initially it turns his friends against him. Sam's business partner will come to Bobby after the death of Sam. And he'll say, listen, I can spend some of this label money. Like, because remember, Sam owns this label. He's like, I can spend some of this money and we can promote you and your brothers. And I think we can get you in a pretty good spot. Like, he's still doing business after Sam dies. Basically, that's all it is, right? Because they're an act on his label. And Bobby will go to Barbara and tell her that this guy's like trying to take her money, basically. Like, hey, that money belongs to you, Barbara. I don't know why he's out spending that money on me or on my brothers. He shouldn't be doing that, which is, I don't really think, accurate. But that kind of posturing, not popular with other people. Hey, it's Brian from Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories. What's up? You know it's that time of year. We've already given you one chance at winning Louder Than Life tickets. You want to see some of your favorite bands in Louisville, Kentucky at the Highlands Festival Fairgrounds at the end of September this year. Now we have another chance for you to win passes. This is how it's going to work. You know that we ask you to write into this show on a regular basis and ask us the questions, the burning questions that you have about rock and roll. So the way we want to reward folks for listening this time is if you write us a question about a band that is on the bill at Louder Than Life, and we answer that question on the show, then you not only get a podcast episode in which you are featured, you get tickets to that day of the fest to see that band live on stage. You say, wait a second, who are these bands? What bands do I have to choose from? Slipknot, The Offspring, Slayer, Motley Crue, Falling in Reverse, Korn, Breaking Benjamin, Disturbed, Evanescence, Five Finger Death Punch, Judas Priest, Stained, Chevelle, Hailstorm. How about Sum 41, Tom Morello? We'll take anyone about Rage Against the Machine. We'll count them, okay? Mastodon, Saison, Body Count. We've talked about Body Count on the show, haven't we? How about Health, Drugs, Sponge, Pup? God, I love Pup. That's just like the stuff in the bigger font. Find out for yourself which bands you have questions about. Send us an email to wearethestoryguys@gmail.com, and you might get a podcast episode with a your question answered and some tickets. There is a archived Jet Magazine article that is in the show notes. That's amazing. It's actual photos of this article. Okay. Let me read Barbara's quote. Quote, "I feel that Sam would certainly want me to do this," Barbara insisted of her then upcoming marriage. 77 days. So we're jumping. They get together, come to the funeral together. So within like a week. And then 77 days later, they're getting married. Quote, "I feel, and he did too," she's referencing Sam, "that the time has nothing to do with it. There is so little time to be happy. So if you find it and you want it, you should pursue it. Be happy in love." This was like our motto. Be happy, whatever it takes. "Sam and I," this is Barbara continuing, "like other couples, sat down and discussed this. And his only desire was to see that the kids and I would be happy forever, with him or without him." So she says that, much like my wife and I, they had this conversation. "Hey, if anything happens to me, what should I do?" And to hear her tell it, his response was the opposite of my wife's, which was, "Don't have sex with my friends." She would like you to believe, at least as she tells it to Jet Magazine in the weeks after this, that he was basically like, "Listen, you know, just be happy. Just be happy. I don't care. Do whoever you want. Be happy." I find this a little hard to believe. Given what we know about Sam, given his propensity to run around on this relationship, I don't know, man. I don't know. Who knows? Not my business, right? Not your business. I just think describing that exact scenario and discussing it and then talking about doing that in Jet Magazine is pretty wild. So again, back to what I said a minute ago about Bobby's career and what happens, right? This is not a good move for Bob's career. He definitely did not do this to sell records because he basically gets blacklisted. The Valentinos had considered breaking up anyway when the Sam thing happened because they were just devastated. But when they do consider powering on, Bobby will actually proactively remove himself from the equation because there's bad blood between him and his brothers about all of this. Then he'll go and try to get himself a solo deal. He'll cut a record. No one will play it. It's hot potato. No one wants to touch this thing. Openly refused by many DJs across the country. And they will say, "I'm not playing music from," quote, "that kid who married Sam Cooke's wife." They won't even call him by name. Now, if that was the worst that happened, it probably would have been manageable. But he gets way more than blacklisted. I'm going to read you this headline from Rare Soul. "Bobby Womack marries Sam Cooke's widow," semicolon. That's a powerful instrument in the English language, the semicolon. Bobby Womack marries Sam Cooke's widow, semicolon, gets pistol whipped. Basically, here's the story. Bobby and Barbara go to Chicago, even though Sam's brother lives there and has told them, don't come to Chicago. So, in his autobiography, Bobby just says, I figured Charles was going to try something, so I decided to be proactive. I can't stay out of Chicago my entire life. So I just go to Chicago and I tell the guy, let's meet up. Here's a story. Quote, when Charles arrived with his brothers, David and LC, he pistol whipped Bobby, beat him to the point that his teeth went through his lips, rendering him unconscious. I opened the door and Charlie punched me. He beat me so bad my whole head was swelled up like a melon. He even broke my jaw. So Barbara figured, this is probably not going to be good. This is all going to go south. So she brought a gun. And at about the point where the teeth go through the lips, she pulls that piece out and attempts to fire. Thing is, Bobby had already taken the bullets out of the pistol before the brothers even showed up. Charles Cooke, he gets a number of charges thrown at him, including assault. He's released on $1,000 bail, but Bobby won't prosecute. And so the charges are eventually dropped. So what do you do if you're in Bobby's situation? You have made this decision in your personal life, and it has wrecked your professional life. How do you respond? In retrospect, a pretty smart move he makes. And honestly, it may have, if nothing else, increased the impact he will have on pop music for the next several decades. There's a version of this where he doesn't do this, or he doesn't even get into this relationship with Barbara, and we may not necessarily know who he is. This drives him to choose another path for a while. He agrees to be in the background instead of the foreground. So he ends up just basically going into the studio and being a working musician. Now, we mentioned he was a guitar player, but I didn't tell you where you have heard his guitar playing. You've not just heard it on Bobby Womack records. Maybe you've never listened to a Bobby Womack record. Here's where you've heard his guitar playing. Suspicious Minds, Son of a Preacher Man, The Letter by the Box Tops, and that's all after he tours and records with Ray Charles. And he plays by ear. There's an incredible story. It's in the show notes. It's about Bobby's audition with Ray Charles. So he goes into this audition. He's with other musicians. And when Ray comes in, they've handed out a booklet that I guess is pretty thick of music that they're supposed to do. And so I think the way it worked is that like Ray would come in and just pick something, like he wouldn't sort of know where things were. Somebody would tell him what the numbers were. So he would be like 54, 35, 76 or whatever. And then they would play those songs. People knew to go to those. They were supposed to go to those pages. They were supposed to play the charts. So the day that Bobby is auditioning to play with Ray Charles, this happens. They start the song, say it's page 55 or whatever. And someone tips Ray off and says, I don't think this one kid over here, aisle three or whatever, I don't think he's using the book. And Ray's very impressed when he calls him out and makes him do it without the book. And he basically just, like, Bobby tells him, I don't really read music, man. And so Ray's impressed enough to bring him along into his band. He'll play with him for a few years. You know why he quits playing with him? This is amazing. This is an amazing story. Okay. In 2007, Bobby puts out this book. We're going to reference it a lot. In that book, he will claim that Ray Charles used to insist on piloting his own jet. This is Womack from the book. Quote, a blind man playing chess was one thing, but flying a plane, that was different. The first time it happened, it tripped me out. I got aboard the rig where we were flying. It seated about 40, and the whole band was there, and it was Ray Charles' own plane, and I saw him up front in the cockpit, clicking switches and flipping buttons. As soon as we hit the air, the buckle was off, and Ray raced up the aisle towards the cockpit, and I said, where is he going? He never runs like that when he's going on stage to play the piano. And the pilot handed the controls to Ray, and one of the band members told me, Ray always takes over the controls. And now this is Bobby. That freaked me out. That's unbelievable. In the show notes, there are pictures of Ray Charles piloting a plane. Let me tell you, I have verified that they are PR campaign pictures. So this is not him actually piloting a plane. But Bobby claims this legit happened. I don't know. The pieces of Bobby's book that I've read, I call into question a little bit. They seem a little fantastic. But as you're going to hear for the next few minutes, as we continue to talk about this guy, there's a lot of stuff verified about him that is very fantastic, that definitely did happen. So this guy lived an insane life. And I don't know, maybe Ray Charles was trying to fly his plane. So let's continue to talk about this in exile period that I'm just going to call it that. That's not really what he called it, that Bobby faces. So there's a period where he's background studio musician, as we've talked about, but he's still writing songs. He writes a whole bunch of songs and has no place to put them. He can't record them himself. He's just sitting in on sessions and stuff. But he's made friends with Wilson Pickett, one of the best, right? In a 2-year period, Wilson Pickett will do 17 Bobby Womack songs. So you might know, if you're a Wilson Pickett fan at all, a bunch of Bobby Womack songs, because he basically becomes the ghostwriter for Wilson Pickett. This is great. This is great. It's sort of a, I don't know that it's a redemption story. It's an interesting story. It could end here, it seems like, right? We say, oh, this guy got in this relationship. Everybody turned against him. He went on and made some of the greatest records of all time, just as a musician. And he lived his life that way. End of story, right? Dude, not how this story ends. We're not, oh my God. Okay, so drawing your attention back to the Jet Magazine piece. Like I said, it's in the show notes if you want to go look at it. So you can see this in the literal black and white from when I think 64, when this story runs. There is a portion where the writer who is writing this interviews Sam Cooke's dad. Okay? And he asks him about this whole affair between Bobby and Barbara. And Sam's dad says something that is documented as being said in 1964. And here it is. Quote, "What we don't like is this 30-year-old woman marrying a 20-year-old boy and bringing him over to Sam's 11-year-old girl, Linda." Remember? I said this way back in 1953, long before they're married. Sam and Barbara have a kid, and at this point, she is getting pretty close to being a teenager. So just about the time that the world is starting to forget about how Bobby Womack took his mentor's wife, and they're starting to let him back in the music biz a little bit, right around 1970, Bobby makes a new decision. And he starts having sex with his stepdaughter. This is from his memoir. Quote, "I'm lying there kissing Linda, and the light comes on." I like how casual that is. "I'm just lying there kissing my stepdaughter. No biggie." The light comes on. Quote, "You dirty fucking bastard. What are you doing with my daughter?" It was Barbara. End quote. After that, Barbara will shoot Bobby with a .32. It will graze his scalp as he is running out of the house and into the garage. That is why they abruptly divorced in 1970. Barbara and her daughter never spoke again. I'm still not done. This is still not the end of the Bobby Womack story. The weird thing about this, if you start to research this at all, because I know now you're like, Brian's making this up. We have jumped the shark. We have jumped the shark on this episode. I don't disagree with you. And if you start to look around, Bobby seems to be in control of this narrative. There's not much out there about this other than what he says, which is a little strange. You would think there would be a little bit more in the news and otherwise. The legend is there. The lore is there. People will often bring this up in conversation about, you know, crazy behavior and doing someone wrong. But there's not a lot out there. But it gets even more complicated because of what Linda will do next. So first, she co-writes a song with him. I'm talking about the teenager. So Barbara and Bobby are over after this incident, right? This doesn't last long. So they get together in 64. This is in 70. So it's like 6 years. And then in like 71 or 72, he writes a song with Linda Womack. Or I'm sorry. Spoiler alert, Linda. Then she will marry another Womack. In the show notes, there's an interview with Linda and Cecil Womack. This is the one she ends up marrying. Remember, I said there were the Womack brothers. There's five of them, the Valentinos. Now, in this article, Linda and Cecil are interviewed separately about how they got together and how they fell in love. And supposedly, Cecil asked Linda to marry him the first time around this same time as the funeral, when she was 11 or 12. And they both decide that's not appropriate. But he just basically says, like, listen, I think you're special if you want to get married. And, like, Sam, who is dead, did the same thing. He did the same thing to Barbara, right? He went to her when she was 13 and started a relationship with her. So here's the wild thing, though. So I feel like you almost have to write this down because we're going to start to get on these tangents of, like, who is connected to who in a sexual way. All right. So Cecil will ask Linda to marry him when she is 11 or 12. They're like, okay, ha, 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 that's funny. But they're close. Remember, the families are together. They're like old friends. Sam has mentored all the Womacks. And all of them are older than Bobby. Bobby's the youngest. So Cecil's older. So then he will marry Mary Wells. So after this whole conversation, several years down the road, they'll continue to be friends, but it's never really romantic, I don't think. Then he marries Mary Wells. Mary Wells, huge Motown singer. We don't have time to get into this, but amazing career, etc. They're briefly married. And I say briefly, for a decade. They're married for a decade. And when that ends, then Cecil and Linda get together. They're together for a long time. They record as a duo. By the late 70s, they put out an album, Linda and Cecil Womack, as Womack and Womack. You can go find this. And then they have three daughters over the time that they're together. And those three daughters now are a musical act of their own. Now, it gets crazier. Remember, we've expanded the frame away from Bobby for a second. We're talking about his brother Cecil. Cecil ends up marrying Mary Wells. And when Mary Wells and Cecil break up, she has a kid with another Womack. There's five Womack brothers. I can't even keep them straight at this point. I think a modern therapist would have a lot of things to discern and reconcile between the Cook families and the Womack families. There's clearly a confusing level of overlap and some complicated feelings around, like, where protectorship and romance and loyalty and sex and all those things come together. And we haven't even talked about Harry yet. So I think we've talked about every Womack, maybe Cecil, except for Harry. So there's Bobby, Cecil, the one that Mary has a kid with. Then there's maybe another one, and then there's Harry. So Harry is killed by his girlfriend. And it also indirectly involves Bobby. We're going to bring the story back to Bobby. So Bobby sees that Harry and his girlfriend have been fighting a lot. And this is after everything with Barbara. So he's single again. And he just, like, he's about to go out. There's a period where the Valentinos get back together for a little bit with Bobby. This is after everything. And I think that's what's going on in this story. I think they're going out. But he tells him, listen, you can stay here and just, like, take a break. He's like, stay at my house. The rest of us go out on tour. You just lay low and enjoy your life for a few minutes, and you can just stay at my house. This is what he tells Harry. So while they're gone and he's staying at Bobby's house, the girlfriend shows up, finds women's underwear in the room where supposedly Harry is sleeping, and then stabs him with a steak knife. And the underwear legitimately not connected to him. of course, they had been left there by a new girl who Bobby had been sleeping with. So it should probably be noted. I feel like now there's like this obvious question. Was Bobby doing a lot of drugs? And yes, the bad decision-making can definitely be blamed at least partly on drugs. He liked to party with Sly Stone. This was a thing. He talks about it in his memoir a lot. And he says to Rolling Stone in 1984, quote, I was really off into the drugs, blowing as much coke as I could blow, and drinking and smoking weed and taking pills. Doing that all day, staying up 7 or 8 days straight. Me and Sly were running partners. End quote. Now, regardless of who your drug buddy is, one piece of advice, pretty standard, that I feel like we can drop in here. Do not let your drug buddy name your kids. That feels practical to me. Bobby did not follow that advice. Sly Stone will suggest that he name one of his kids Truth Bobby, and then he will name Truth Bobby's brother Bobby Truth. No fucking lie, that happened. Look it up. Truth Bobby will die just a few months after he's born when he gets stuck between a bed and a wall. And obviously, this sort of tragedy does not help the drug problem. Meanwhile, the kid that Bobby has with Barbara Cook way back in the 60s will end up taking his own life in the mid-80s. It's all very, very, very tragic. And I'm not bringing it up to laugh at. I point it out for two reasons. One, empathy. This guy dealt with some shit. Two, the mirror of what Sam's life looks like and what Bobby's life ends up looking like. It's really odd if you plot out the trajectory. Young, gospel singing, breaks into pop, gets into these relationships, loses a child, torrid affair, like all of these things that are very similar in what will end up happening and the way their lives turn out. But I think the wildest part of this whole thing, regardless of all of the stories we've touched on that could probably be episodes of their own, the wildest thing to me is that Bobby will continue to have a pretty amazing career in the midst of all of this drama and these insane decisions. We already stated that he's on some of these great records. He ends up in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And while his output will get spread out in the 90s, he collaborates and records with people all the way up to 2012. And here's where, if you are a younger listener or a pretty hip listener, you might know Bobby Womack because you saw him credited or listed on a Gorillaz record. He shows up on Plastic Beach by Gorillaz. And in 2012, Damon Albarn, who of course is the mastermind behind Blur and the Gorillaz, will take on the recording and producing of what will become Bobby's last album called The Bravest Man in the Universe. Murdoch highly recommends some of the stuff on this record because you hear Bobby near the end of his life and you hear what he's able to do, what he sounds like, and it's all set to modern music that involves the mastermind behind Gorillaz. It's really interesting. It gets released after his death when he loses a fight with colon cancer in 2012. Or 2014, I think. So the record's in 2012. I think he dies in 2014. So he's been dead for a decade. But all the way to the end, still respected for what he was able to put into music and still creating some pretty amazing stuff. The Bobby Womack story is a wild one. I would love to hear if you've got any insight or opinions, clarifying questions you'd like to have answered. It's easy to get in touch with us. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. Wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. The other thing I need you to do is support the show. This happens on Patreon. It's a pretty easy way to get involved. You go to patreon.com /rockandrollbedtimestories. And there you're going to find a way to give us a few bucks and get some extra stuff throughout the week and throughout the month. We really can't do this show without you and your support. And here's one more thing. If you enjoy this show, if you enjoy these stories, if you've never left us a review, if you don't like us, stop listening now. No, I'm kidding. Well, not really. If you do like this show, an easy thing you can do, even if you don't want to support the show on Patreon, is go to whatever platform you listen on, whether that be Apple Podcasts or Spotify, but especially if it's a place where you can write a review with words, go do that. Let people know. The more reviews you have, the easier it is for those, you know, the algorithms and everything all start to kick episodes up for people to hear. And it's easier for people to find us. We just need that help from you. So if you can do that for us, that's, I know it's a big ask. Take just a few minutes today, go to wherever you listen to the show, review it with 5 stars and tell other folks. And if you can support us on Patreon, it's patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. Murdoch's not here, so I'll have to do both parts. But you know what I'm going to say? Until next time, we need you to keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.